this is Dave Valanchis, and welcome back to Community Hospitalist Podcast. I'm here today with the assembly of our nurses on one of our best nursing units, 6C, and again with Justine. And today we plan to review non-pharmacologic management and prevention of delirium and the placebo effect. So I'll hand it over to Justine, who's prepared some a review of an article that will be a starting point for general discussion.
Okay, so today we're going to review an article that was put out in Annals of Internal Medicine, and it was a study with the NIH about delirium. The study defined delirium as recent onset of a change in awareness, impaired memory, disorganized thinking, and impaired attention span. Delirium in patients that were studied was also associated with a longer length of stay, and increased need for long-term care was associated. So what the NIH did was it looked back at 8 studies. 3 were randomized controlled trials, 2 were non-randomized, and 3 were historical controlled trials. Patients in these studies were older than 18, and they were either hospitalized or in a long-term care facility. So basically, to summarize the article, it was determined by looking back at all of these patients that prevention and non-pharmacologic management is the best way to prevent delirium. There's a lot of treatments that you can do once it's already started, but they kind of summarized prevention of delirium for at-risk adults. So I'll just go over those. There's 11 recommendations, and the first one is to make sure that you know your patient. It's important that if a patient is on a unit, you try and stay with them so that they become familiar with you and you with them. The second recommendation is to give an analysis of their risk to get delirium in the first 24 hours that they come here. So if you know the patient, that becomes easier, and try and take a history from either family members or other nursing staff that's been with them. The third recommendation is to address how cognitively impaired they are, and you can help them with this by making sure light in their room is on in the day and telling them what day it is, telling them who they are and who you are every time you go into the room. Nurses, it would be really helpful if you could try and assess how hydrated they are. If you notice that they're not drinking their water, they're not getting fluids, that's important. And it's also important to assess for signs of hypoxia and infection by letting the doctor know if they have a fever, if their O2 sats are decreasing, things like that. It's important to encourage the patient to be mobile if they're able to be mobile. Sometimes it takes consulting physical therapy, but a patient that was mobile before they came and they're able to be mobile and they just don't want to be, it's important to encourage them to do that. It's also important to assess if they're in pain, which sometimes is hard, but you using nonverbal clues, like if they're grimacing or if they're unable to move in bed, it's important to assess if they're in pain. Another thing you can do is you can tell them what meds they're getting when you give them, instead of just saying, take your medicine today. You can say, I'm giving you this medicine for this purpose, and it sometimes helps the patient to understand what their medical illnesses are, even if they are delirious. This is a hard one, but promote good sleep patterns. A lot of patients have trouble in the hospital, but sleep hygiene is still a good idea for patients when they're here and to get into a hospital sleep routine. You can also address sensory impairment and addressing reversible causes of sensory impairment. Like some patients, they're not bathing as much in the hospital, and they might have a conductive hearing loss from earbuds, and that can be easily fixed by telling the doctor and having their ears flush. So addressing those reversible causes are important. So those were the top the question was, how did they identify delirium in the first 24 hours? And they kind of, it says they use a multi-component intervention, which basically, I guess they were trying to say, assess if there's any change in mental status or if there's any risk factors for change in mental status, like age, mobility, just like the general mental status of the patient coming in. So getting, it might not even be talking to the patient, it might be talking to his family and saying, you know, they're a lot more decompensated than when they came.
Going to be using the short CAM tool by Dr. Inouye, and there's four questions. We're going to be doing it on admission daily, and if there's a change in mental status to identify delirium.
So I think with this article that Justine found, it's good. I mean, what it is a summary of the NICE guidelines. That's from England. So they take eight main studies. So there wasn't one particular delirium screening they used throughout the eight studies. I mean, there's multiple different delirium assessments. The CAM is probably the most commonly used. And the problem, of course, with the CAM is that it doesn't change with time. So it's an on-off. In other words, it's not the severity. But, I mean, it's probably the most well-validated delirium assessment, delirium tool. I think what the focus of this review from NICE was for prevention of delirium, so taking people at risk for delirium. And what are the ways that we can prevent delirium? Because, as you know, we don't have really great drugs for delirium. And once the patient's delirious, they're here longer and they're at risk for a variety of things. So I think the couple takeaways, because this is a summary of the guidelines, which are on the web, and there are about 450 pages. So Justine and I did not go through the entire 450-page document. Some of the take-homes that I had were in just kind of thinking about different things we could do differently. And one of the recommendations was to address pain by assessing for pain, and because pain can cause delirium. And they actually, in the NICE guidelines, go through a variety of studies in terms of narcotics for delirium, and it's far from clear that narcotics cause delirium, though that's kind of what we typically say, and so I think in particular when we have patients with hip fracture or in pain, that trying to withhold narcotics could actually make things worse a little bit. Pulling from the NICE summary, they went through a variety of individual narcotics. Certainly, but there's some evidence that the effect of delirium or the effect of narcotics is more from uncontrolled pain than from events themselves. So that one statement that struck me is just in reference to a study about IV, the author suggested that it is the untreated pain as opposed to a low dose of opioid that is the risk factor for developing a delirium, and their consensus is confirmed. So that, and I think the other thing that is I struggle with is I'm yelling a lot at the patients and they can't hear me. Justine mentioned this. It's not clear to me that pharmacologic management of insomnia is the best practice in the hospital. So I think what this prevention thing is looking at is basically the total experience of the patient in a lot of ways, and trying to look at how a lot of things we do for the patients could be contributing to their delirium. So I don't know, Maria, I know you're working on this stuff. Maybe any comments about the nursing training that you guys are going through? Yeah. Do you mind? Not that you have to answer this question. Are there any things that you think that we could be doing better on the unit to prevent delirium?
Well, I think not only for delirium, but medication-related, the one intervention I think we could use for all of our patients is when we're going to give them their medications, telling them the name of the medication and the reason that they're taking it. It doesn't just work for, you know, that delirious population, but it's something that we lack as a unit. You know, we go in and say, oh, I have your morning meds, but we don't always necessarily identify what the medications are for. And I see that when we get different scores back in general, that people are getting medications, but they're not sure what they're taking them for, especially if it's something that's new that we've added while they've been here. So I do think that is one intervention that would be helpful from a unit perspective if we were able to kind of take hold and work on that from the nursing perspective.
About anything we do from the medication or physician perspective that you see, or provider perspective, that we could be doing better to reduce delirium?
Stop ordering Haldol. Is it the number one? I feel like sometimes it's not the benefit for our patients from what we see the reaction. Or instead of trying other interventions, that always seems to just be the first thing that we try to give them. I don't know. I don't like them. I don't like that drug. I mean, that's just me personally. I don't know that we always see good effects from it. Yeah. I don't know that we always see positive effects where we see that where it relaxes and calms them. I sometimes think that we see more patients who have an adverse reaction to it, and it makes the behavior worse, which then I guess would indicate that it's not a, you know, an acute delirious patient. So I don't know. I
mean, what I see is sometimes when we have a delirious patient, we give them a medicine and we quit thinking about anything else that we could do. I guess I would say if we have somebody who's delirious, I think medication management there's a variety of different drugs you can try. Like Haldol, I mean, it's just that no drug is perfect. But we should also be, at the same time, doing all of the other things that go along with the delirium prevention and treatment. So that would be one thing I see. So were there any other... I'll hand it back.
Well, and I'm thinking with the use... Oh, I'm Kim, the nursing director on this really awesome unit. So with the use of Haldol, I think then consistently using the CAM tool, if that is the number one recommendation from the pharmacologic standpoint, just using that not for the nurses to diagnose, but to recognize, have our physicians diagnose that Haldol would be the appropriate drug, then at that point that we would in turn hope to see that impact where it has the positive effect on them. So I sometimes think that we use the drug too freely without necessarily knowing if it's an acute delirium.
All right, well, moving on to a different topic. Justine looked at an article about placebos that actually stemmed from a recent NPR segment that I heard the author on. So I'll kick it to Justine. And Justine, if you had any final comments for delirium, feel free to jump in.
Article that I looked at was called Placebos Without Deception, a Randomized Control Trial in Irritable Bowel Syndrome. And the article starts off by saying that the placebo effect is very powerful and can have an impact significantly on subjective patient complaints. However, in studies, it's hard for providers to take advantage of the placebo effect because it does violate patient autonomy and knowing about their medication that they're receiving. And some providers feel that they can't gain patient trust and proper informed consent with the use of placebos. So that's kind of the background for this article. The article also says that IBS is one of the top 10 primary care complaints, and they said that IBS was defined as pain with altered bowel habits that for many patients decreases their quality of life, uses a lot of healthcare resources, and there's been no global relief for patients for this syndrome. And the objective of the study was to take an open-label placebo versus no treatment in relieving the symptoms of IBS when the patients came back and reported it to their provider. So an open-label placebo means that the medication is marked as placebo, so they knew that they were receiving a placebo. The way the study was conducted was, again, with the open label placebo for half the patients and no treatment group for the other patients. It was conducted at a single academic medical center, and again, the placebo was truthfully described. The patients were told it was like a sugar pill to help with mind and body healing processes. Patients were assessed on day 1, day 11, and day 21 of the study. So it was a 3-week study, and they saw the provider 3 times. The first time they saw the provider, it was for 30 minutes, and the second 2 times, it was for about 15 minutes. And the providers were blind to whether the patients were receiving a placebo or not. Patients were included in the study if they were older than 18 and met the Rome 3 criteria for irritable bowel syndrome. They also were included if they had a greater than 150 on the IBS symptom severity scale, and a diagnosis of IBS was confirmed by a doctor or an NP who was specialized in GI. Patients were excluded if they had alarm symptoms like weight loss, fevers, heat-positive stool, if they had pelvic floor dyssynergy, other comorbidities, specifically GI, if they had an abnormal EKG before they started the study, if they had surgery in the past 30 days, or if they were pregnant or breastfeeding. During the study, you were able to continue your normal IBS medication regimen if you were stable on the regimen 30 days before you started the trial. So the interventions in this trial were that each patient on day one got a discussion of the placebo for about 15 minutes of just talking about the placebo, and four main points were emphasized for every single patient, and they were that the placebo effect is very powerful, that the body can automatically respond to placebo pills, a positive attitude helps but isn't necessary, and taking the pills faithfully is critical. And so the patients that were given the placebo were instructed to take two pills twice daily. And at day 11, each patient was seen again, whether they took the placebo or not, and those four placebo points were reinforced since the providers were blind to the study. And then at day 21, patients were seen again and assessed for 15 minutes, and they completed various scales to see if they got any improvement. And the scales were the IBS Global Improvement Scales, and they rated their symptoms as 1, that they were worse, or 7, they were significantly improved. They also did the IBS Symptom Severity Scale, which consists of 5 100-point scales that evaluate severity, frequency, distension, dissatisfaction with bowel habits, and interference with quality of life. They also completed a quality of life scale, which contains 34 items. And when these questions were asked, the doctors, again, were blind to whether the patients were on placebo or not. Then a statistical analysis was performed, and it involved the 80 patients. 43 received no treatment, and 37 received the placebo. And in the end, the results showed ultimately that open-label placebo had an increased effect on quality of life and global improvement, with a decrease in symptoms and an increase in acute relief. And it was measured by standard deviation, showing on both day 1 and day 11 that patients with the open placebo had improved their symptoms. During the trial, there were some adverse events, 3 that happened, 3 patients with the placebo and 5 patients with no treatment, and they were most commonly upper respiratory infection, pain, or they developed some sort of rash that were not related to taking the placebo. So this is the first randomized control trial that is trying to demonstrate symptom improvement without deceiving the patients about whether or not they're receiving the placebo. And the study thought that because they gave an accurate description of the placebo, they told patients to have realistic expectations, and they gave patients very specific instructions as to how to take the placebo and how to, or what the placebo is. And they also had 3 visits with their provider, and they got time spent with them, with the provider. So overall, the patients had an increased quality of life. They had an increase in acute relief and a decrease in symptom severity. And what the trial thought about this was that since the treatment of IBS can exhaust healthcare resources and is exhaustful for the patient to pay for, that a wait and watch method may be more beneficial to patients versus just taking another medication for their IBS. And the limits to this study was that the population was pretty small, only 80 patients, and it was only a 3-week look at their IBS. Also, it's hard in a study like this because It's a subjective measurement, so it's what the patient tells you, versus it's hard to measure something objectively about how the symptoms got better. So overall, I think it demonstrated that being honest with your patients and telling them it's a placebo, it makes it more easy to inform the patients and give the patients autonomy, but you can still assess their symptoms.
So, Justine, that was a terrific review of what I found to be like a really interesting concept. And this guy, Dr. Kapchuk, was featured on NPR recently. And this is from the article Justine reviewed is from December 2010 out of Boston. So what was really different about this article was, you know, most of the time when we're talking about a placebo, we're comparing the placebo to some other active treatment. And we all know the people in the placebo arm get better, What they're doing in Boston is from the NIH trying to figure out what the placebo effect is, and there then like how it can be manipulated and what to do with it. So the placebo effect seems to be more pronounced in things that have a subjective component, pain, shortness of breath, something like that. And this is kind of similar to an article we had discussed in a previous podcast about asthma treatment with sham nebulizers and acupuncture. So what was really fascinating, though, to me about this article was that the patients were told they were getting a placebo. So I just can't believe that they got better, and so I'm shocked, and so what they postulate is that it's, you know, because no one really believes that the sugar pill is doing anything biologic, but there's something about the therapeutic relationship established between the healthcare team and the patient that improves the patient's symptoms. And so I thought that's one of the things that was important about this. Not that I plan to give people placebo. I mean, I think that, you know, we don't give people placebo. But where we kind of skirt the line sometimes is I do feel like we give people a medicine hoping that they'll get better without believing that actually the medicine's going to make them a lot better. There we're probably in some ways using a placebo effect. So for our patients with subjective complaints, pain, and everything, I thought that this article was interesting because I just couldn't believe it, and because I thought it demonstrated something that's occurring that goes beyond just, you know, given this or that medicine. So I'll kick it to the nurses because they always know more about the patients anyway.
I really did think it was interesting that full disclosure that they were getting a placebo, which was like a sugar pill, and they reported that their symptomology had actually improved over that 3-week time frame. And thinking about what you said, I think another limitation to the study would be, you know, those who were on a medication regimen that was steady regime 30 days prior, if they had received, you know, the placebo, that if they were having a flare-up and their medications kind of took care of it, so they would have an improved symptomology, versus if somebody was not on their medication for that 30 days, then they did not continue with their medication. So I don't know if it really accounted for that. It just stated kind of that, okay, well, if they were on a steady regime, then so you don't really even know if those on a steady or those who were not on a steady regime were the ones getting the placebo effect. So I think that was another limitation to it. But I am
really surprised that they reported better symptoms. Like an improvement. That just kind of blows my mind a little bit. So I guess there's something to be said for communication and, you know, full transparency and that component, which is something that we constantly preach in our institution all the time about the transparency and the communication. And, you know, that was done and they had a positive effect. I think it's interesting.
Any comments from any of our other nurses? No? Yeah, I heard this article. I can't really actually get over it. I mean, it's not that, you know, this, I guess it is surprising. It's not surprising. I guess the main surprise for me was I always thought that the placebo worked a little bit because we were fooling the patients. And like, oh, well, maybe I got the drug. Maybe I didn't get the drug. Well, I think I'm getting the drug. Therefore, I'm going to get better. So this kind of would fly in the face of that it has actually nothing to do with that thought process. And it's more that somebody's paying attention to them, caring for them, and trying to do something, I suppose. So obviously we don't understand everything about the placebo effect, but the other things that we do to help patients besides dispensing whatever medicines we give are clearly very, very important.
I was just going to comment, too, that at each of the visits, they then reinforce those four particular points, though, that, and I don't know exactly what they were off the top of my head, but I think reinforcing those as well about, you know, what can happen with the placebo effect and, you know, positive attitude, even though it's not necessary, but certainly it could help. So maybe that reinforcement in addition, so they had that thought process going, and then they believe that, you know, their symptomology had improved.
I've kind of been doing that a little more in my this article and in line with some other articles in the past about they've kind of highlighted a placebo effect. I've been trying to tell patients that they're going to get better, hoping that I have some sort of Jedi mind trick power. And this article would maybe we actually have that type of effect. So I think that's a good point, that maybe it's some of the things that they were told. So I think that, you know, but, you know, what was interesting was it wasn't like the deception part, or not, you know, not intentional deception. Obviously, if you're in a study, you know, you could be getting a placebo. But that aspect of it didn't seem to be the main issue. So, Justine, any thoughts?
One thing that I thought was interesting, that the patients were all told that it could help with mind and body healing processes, even though it was a sugar pill. So I don't know how much that had an effect on them, or if it made them, if they weren't thinking about their healing process before, if it sparked something, even though it was just a sugar pill. So I think that should also be taken into account about how much effect they had, did it have about what they were doing.
Absolutely. Well, podcast listeners, another important podcast, and hopefully some food for thought. So we'll, until next time, keep up the downloads, and we'll give you some more information shortly. Bye.